Grosso from Vancouver to win it for Canada! Canada came! Canada conquered! Canada gold!
Buchanan with the cross in towards Alphonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar! A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades! Finally arrives!
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo, Alexander Gonguet-Rujic, and your host, Ben Steiner.
Hey there, and welcome, folks, back to Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 123 of NFP. Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gonguet-Rujic and Peter Galindo. Make sure to rate, review, subscribe everywhere you get your podcasts. Also, follow us on social at Northern Football, at Galindo PW, at Alex Gonguet-Rujic, and at Ben Steiner 00. Welcome, guys, back to the podcast. We're not in person this week, but certainly a fun week of recording in person.
It was, but we'll hopefully be getting more soon because potentially big move for me in the works. Going back to my roots, we'll see if that comes to fruition. But until then, we'll be doing it remotely from now on, already causing problems. We've had to delay the show a little bit, but hopefully from here on out, it'll be smoother.
Yeah, a little bit delayed. Sorry for that. We also have taken your feedback based on our survey and have made a couple changes to the show today, more coming in the future as well. But thank you very much for responding to our survey. But big news, the CSA accepted government demands. Canadian Minister of Sport Pascal Saint-Ange imposed new conditions for Canada Soccer to receive government funds, of course, to continue receiving government funds. This includes a financial audit, a governance review, and they must accept advice from an external advisory group. Saint-Ange sent this letter on Tuesday saying that she shares concerns about the organization's lack of financial transparency and ongoing labor disputes. Canada Soccer released a statement via Interim General Secretary Jason DeVos, welcoming all of the conditions. Any thoughts on this?
I guess we'll believe it till we see it, right? I'm pretty confident with Jason running things as the Interim General Secretary. You know that he's going to have the best interests of the sport at heart and the Federation at heart, and he's going to try to balance both sides very well. And it's a necessary step, too, because that's kind of one of the things we had to take away from the Heritage Committee meetings was, did we really get any more financial transparency than before we started these meetings? And you probably say, no, not really. So at least in some way, this is going to force the Federation to just be more forthcoming with the money that comes in, the money that comes out, how it's spent, things like that. And hopefully that leads to just a better relationship between players and Federation too.
Yeah, this has been a dossier that, you know, Pascal Saint-Ange has been working on as part of just, you know, the overall safe sport umbrella. So, you know, encouraging to see finally a bit of, I guess, you know, results, sort of a final action, so to say, after all the hearings, some sort of, you know, demands. And now, you know, obviously, hopefully Canada Soccer can look at that because, you know, government funds are very huge for, you know, NSO. Given as we talked as much about the financial situation as we have. So hopefully those demands can be met and, you know, a big step can be taken towards safe sport, transparency, and all the things that everyone wants from Canada Soccer.
I do think it's quite important that they keep the federal funds because without that, they're not with much money, like basically nothing given the CSB deal. But in terms of actually changing things from all these audits, I don't really still see where the change necessarily comes from. It's a first step for sure. And I think the Heritage Committees were maybe the preliminary step to this step, but it's still not sort of actual change that's coming. And that won't necessarily come until the CSB deal is looked at maybe a little bit closer or tweaked in some way. But it's a step. I think it's the needed step, and it's the step in this process as well. That's how national sports organizations in this country work.
And we're going to get, hopefully, more clarity regarding the Noonan quotes when he was talking about how they're working with the CSA to tweak that deal. He never really went into the specifics, which I guess I can kind of understand why, but it'd be fascinating to know those terms too, because if they end up tweaking it in some way, whether that's Canada Soccer keeps a little more of the commercial revenue than what they've been keeping before, whatever the case is, that's going to be obviously very huge towards all of this that we've just been talking about.
Ultimately, as long as we're seeing a sort of deal That in the end, the national teams are obviously happy with, but, you know, the future of the sport, obviously CPL is a big part of that, but, you know, with the Women's Project 8 League coming in, youth camps obviously remain a huge hot button topic given all the movement on the men's side. And of course, the women in the midst of a U20 tournament, you kind of again see some of the gaps, some of the you know, inequalities, that's probably the wrong word, but just some of those gaps that exist between Canada and elsewhere due to a lack of youth team funding. Ultimately, if a deal can be reached that ticks all of those boxes, that would be huge. And a percentage deal, you know, would probably tick a lot of those boxes.
And as well, this week was the Canadian Championship semifinals, and the final is set. It's another all MLS final. The Vancouver Whitecaps will host CF Montreal on June 7. Montreal beat Forge 2-0 at Stade Saputo, while Vancouver cruised past Pacific 3-0 on Vancouver Island. All three of us on location for that one. Vancouver's win overshadowed by Ali Ahmed's injury, who is improving, and he is in better condition than a scary moment at Starlight Stadium. But just thoughts on each semifinal and the final.
Yeah, first of all, amazing that Ali is okay after that, because that looked really devastating. I know we were all at the stadium, and initially we thought, oh, that was just, you know, a really hard tackle from Cedric Toussaint. He stayed down a little bit, but he was motionless for several minutes, and we were all fearing the worst. And thankfully, he quote unquote only came away with a concussion, still a serious injury, of course, and he's still being reduced to light treadmill work and stuff like that around the training complex. But at least he's back in training, he's in that environment, he's working towards a return. That's obviously awesome to see. And in a lot of ways, that kind of, you know, killed off the game, right? Because Vancouver was still shell-shocked from what had happened, and it affected the rest of the first half. That's when Pacific slowly started to take over the game. Second half was a bit better in that regard, but because they had taken a 2-0 lead early, they didn't need to take too many risks. One goalkeeping mistake from Emil Gazdov let Simon Betcher score the goal that killed it off. And, you know, Vancouver were lethal, right? That was the story of the game. James Merriman said as much after the match. They just didn't attack the wide spaces quickly enough. And we saw over the weekend that St. Louis did exactly that. And they ended up winning 3-1 again with some maybe help the other way on the goalkeeping side. But that's really how that semi played out. The Forge Montreal game, I was a little bit surprised that Forge maybe didn't cause as many problems offensively. They had a few decent chances, no doubt, and they missed a couple of clear-cut opportunities. And really, I think that could be the story of really when we talk about the gap between CPL and MLS. That's the big difference. It's just having that composure in the big moments, being able to put your few opportunities away, adjusting somewhat tactically, because in Forge's case, they're going to be very dominant in almost every game they play in the CPL. In this game, they did have a decent share of the ball, but not as much as they'd be used to. They got in behind a couple times, couldn't put the chances away. Chinonso Afor comes off the bench, has like 7 shots, like pretty much right off the bat. Sanusi Ibrahim, as he always has done in the Canadian Championship, just wreaking havoc. And that's really what determined that game. And now we have a pretty intriguing final to come away from it.
I think the thing that really hurt both CPL sides, if you're looking at it from that perspective, is just that they weren't able to get the first goal in both games. And, you know, Forge, they had a good start first half. They kept it even. It was so low event. I think the XG, the cumulative XG for both teams was like less than 0.10 after the first half. Like, it was very low event, very cagey. For Forge, in a moment like that, you got to get some sort of chance. You got to generate a chance. Take it, at least put that pressure on Montreal, because there's that stat in MLS where Montreal pretty much, I want to say, are winless when they don't score first. Like, it's something where, as we mentioned, when they score first, they're able to keep a clean sheet, they're dominant. But when they allow that one to go in, they've struggled to pull results out of that this year. And, you know, the fact that Forge hung around and then that goal they let in, it was one where it was a bit unlucky. You know, Ariel Lasser cuts in and it ends up deflecting in, but the floodgates opened for Montreal after that. They kind of had that freedom of knowing that they had the lead, and the rest was history in that regard. And then as for Pacific, similar deal. I mean, it was, you know, the part that probably hurt James Merriman the most. You could hear it talk. It's like they knew how ruthless the Whitecaps were in transition. Like, they're a team that always looks better in transition, but Pacific just got so overeager on one chance. Maybe they saw they were going to score and, you know, got maybe, you know, thought back to Ferryside part one, thought they were going to get that lead and it was all going to drop for them. And all of a sudden you leave a 4v3 versus the Whitecaps and the ball falls to, you know, $1 million player like Julian Gressel. He's not going to miss that chance. And, you know, maybe in the CPL, if you get a little overeager, you leave a transition moment. There's not many players that are going to punish them for that mistake the way Gressel did, just so ruthlessly. And from there, again, once the Whitecaps had that lead and were able to really sit back and hit on the counter, it was almost game over in that regard, because teams in MLS don't really let the Whitecaps do that. That's why, you know, you're trying to score first against Vancouver. You're trying to make sure they put the pressure on you. So for the CPL teams, it was just that. And I guess it really shows that comes down to details for Forge. It shows how important it is to get chances, take them, can't let a team hang around and push and grab that open. And as for Pacific, it shows that once you let an early goal, it can really just completely tilt the field as it did for Vancouver. Like if it wasn't for that Ahmed injury, it probably could have been 4 or 5 nil by halftime the way they were playing, just the momentum they had.
And from Johnny Lower, who do you think Vancouver will trust as their third Canadian in the final after Ahmed's concussion and Hassal's failing in his audition? Montreal don't have this problem as they could start 5 Canadians quite easily. And from Jesse, if Ahmed isn't good to go for the final, who will be the third Canadian to start for Vancouver? Hassal, Johnson, Yao, or another? I'm assuming Raposo and Tybert are the two starting.
Yes, they probably will be. From there, it's going to be fascinating to see how Ahmed recovers. I don't imagine he'll be ready to start in a week's time, because he's definitely not going to play against Houston on Wednesday. He'll likely not feature Saturday. Maybe that final is where he gets named to the match day squad, comes off the bench. Let's just say he's not going to play whatsoever. The next man up would be Levante Johnson. Sergio Cordova doesn't really fit tactically into how Vanni Sartini plays these days. He struggled when he has played. He can't even string passes together sometimes. And Johnson has been lively as a super sub, whether that's in the Canadian Championship or his brief stint in MLS. So why not give him a run out in that regard? Because he can fit in behind Brian White or Simon Betcher, whoever starts up front next to Ryan Gauld, and work hard defensively, provide a bit of a scoring spark. In MLS Next Pro, he's been killing it. He's third, I believe, in XG per 90 among all players with at least 500 minutes played. And he's added about 0.13 expected assists on top of that, which puts him in the top 5 for combined XG plus XA. And even just watch some of the games he plays, and he's really, really lively. So I think he can fit in behind that front two, maybe as a wingback if you really want to take that route. Not so sure if they will. I don't know if you can trust Thomas Hassal in a final, especially when he is rusty. And Sartini doesn't seem high on Karifa Yao yet, although I wonder if he switches to a back three, if maybe he has Yao center that back three just to deal with some of the aerial threats that Montreal has, because we know that's been a bit of a problem for Vancouver, especially when Matthias Laborda doesn't play and usually when Ranko Veselinovic is starting in that back line as well.
I think the easy answer is Levante Johnson. I just think he fits in easier. Like there's more room just to slot him in. Likely, I'd imagine you pair him with Brian White up top. Unfortunately, that would likely mean like a Pedro Vite drops, but obviously you need the three Canadians. That's kind of a non-negotiable in that regard. And I think that would just make sense. You keep your 3-4-2-1, you keep more of your first team, or not 3-4-2-1, 4-2-3-1, or 4-3-2-1, that darn Christmas tree. Raposo at left back, Tybert at that left center mid. Logically, though, I mean, if I was Vanni Sartini, obviously this is way back. I mean, again, this just shows why they should have started Hassal against York. And then if he had a good game, start him against Pacific, because all of a sudden, instead of throwing him in against St. Louis, where maybe you're up against a good team in a hostile environment, you hadn't played in a while, it all kind of catches up to you. Then you could have looked at those games like, okay, maybe we trust him for a final. So if you want a bit of an outside the box shout, give Hassal one of the next two home games, because to be fair to Hassal, I think all of his appearances this year have been on the road, Real España, LAFC, and St. Louis. So give him a home game, because you have two at home and typically you're good at home. Maybe build up his confidence. And if he does well, you could also potentially trust him in a final. I know it's a bit of an outside shot, but again, it's something where we'll talk about it in a bit, but Hassal's confidence hasn't exactly been done any favor. So anything you could do to help that, maybe he ends up making himself an option for the final as well.
And getting into our MLS roundup as well, the big news in MLS was off the pitch involving Toronto FC, certainly a dramatic week in the center of the universe. The Athletic's Tom Bogert, Paul Tenorio, and Josh Cloak wrote a hard-hitting piece on the dysfunction within TFC, from the Italian DPs wanting Bob Bradley out, to them not getting along, to Federico Bernardeschi being reprimanded for vaping, wanting a lucrative deal as Insigne, and claims of nepotism with the Bradleys, and so much more. A lot to process, but your thoughts on the situation? It seems like everything is falling off the rails for TFC, but they did get a win.
Yeah, which is honestly hilarious. Like, it just adds to the whole thing. And also doing it with some young players too, which was kind of nice to see, but I guess we'll get into that in a bit. There's obviously a lot to break down from that story. Most listeners have probably already read the story. If they haven't, that was basically the Coles notes. My one major takeaway with everything was that it all comes back to Bill Manning for me. Every single thing you saw in that story, it all had one funneling route, and that was Manning. From signing Insigne to that massive deal when he's never been the guy, quote unquote, he's never been him in his career, whether that's for Napoli, whether that's for Italy. Like, even during their heyday under Maurizio Sarri, before they obviously won the Scudetto this year, Insigne was really just a piece of the puzzle. The main focal points of that team was Kalidou Koulibaly, Marek Hamsik, Jorginho, and Dries Mertens. You take one of those four guys out, they were a far worse team. They could survive without Insigne. No doubt he was a good player. No doubt he can chip in that way. And I figured in MLS he would be still a solid player, but probably not the player a lot of media were claiming he was going to be. And so to spend that kind of money on him was pretty reckless in my eyes. If you're going to spend that kind of money, spend it on Bernardeschi, who has been that guy during his time at Fiorentina. And we kind of saw from the moment he got there, he was probably and has been the better player of the two. So that was one side of it. Not vetting the fact that Bernardeschi and Insigne don't get along. Like, how do you not talk to people and figure out, hey, will these two work? And I do wonder how much of that was also being pushed by MLSC just to get the big splashy signings in, because we need to market these guys. That's been their strategy for years. But the fact that that wasn't looked into goes to show you the flaws they have with recruitment since Tim Bezpachenko left, since Greg Vanney left. And you add on the fact that Manning has already fired a full-time coach in Chris Armas, fired a full-time sporting director in Ali Curtis. He helped build an incomplete roster. They're with no Michael Bradley replacement, no proper center backs, no clear transfer policy, as I mentioned. And I know that Bezpachenko left in 2019, but Vanney was still there kind of helping them cling to some of their past. They got to MLS Cup in 2019. They made the playoffs in 2020 during the COVID year, but then got knocked out by an expansion Nashville rather handedly as well. And then when he wasn't being afforded more control, when it looked like Vanney was going to sign an extension, then he left for the LA Galaxy. And I don't think it's a coincidence as well why, and it was mentioned in the story too, so many people in soccer operations have departed, because that story mentioned how Manning thinks and believes he's the best scout, recruiter, negotiator, all of that, when clearly that hasn't been true now for 3 years. So it all really just comes back to Bill Manning's ineptitude for me.
I think it just screams a lack of long-term planning post Giovinco, Altidor, Bradley, Vasquez, that whole team. I think it was something where 2019 kind of came together nicely. Obviously, had Alejandro Pozuelo, who ended up adapting well, and you kind of still had a lot of that core. But really, ever since that core has gone away, there's just been mistake after mistake. Now you look again at some of these signings they've made in the past years. Heck, you could argue it almost started with a guy like a Jefferson Soteldo, who immensely talented, huge coup, but you end up looking at all the drama and the issues and how he was sold back so quickly. It's one where maybe, again, a lack of foresight, a lack of vetting, a lack of just overall planning in that regard kind of led to a big splash ending up, ends up costing you in the way it plans. Ditto with signing a Chris Armas and then firing him, less than 6 months later. It feels like, again, if you're going to plan for the first manager post Greg Vanney, you'd like a little bit more. Just something, again, it's something where just there's feels like there's always these decisions and they're always having to be corrected a few months later. And then it just kind of leads to this cycle where you're always cleaning up past messes. And it just feels like really they haven't planned properly for that post Giovinco post Altidore sort of era. And I think the that's just been on the field. So the fact that all of this comes out off the field, it does point to someone like Bill Manning, if, you know, orchestrating all of this, involved in a lot of these hirings, a lot of these signings. You're like, okay, what has been the plan here? What obviously wants to see TFC as a top high spending team? And there's ways to go about that. And again, you bring in a coach like Bob Bradley, and since day one, we've, you know, at least been saying, like, get him a young, flexible number six who can, you know, who can run a little, can play that sort of high tempo game. And they haven't sort of planned it. They've been kind of, again, focusing maybe in other areas of the pitch they shouldn't have. Just little things like that. It just kind of doesn't scream a lack of overall planning. And I think that's ultimately where you end up in a situation like TFC's, where they've got the unfortunate reality of being a team that's paying to win now, but you look at the problems they have on their roster and how they cleared up, it's going to be tough to see a path towards them winning, other than just hope guys get healthy, hope guys somehow gel and go from there, which, again, it's MLS, could work to an extent, but also when you see what other teams around the league are doing, doesn't exactly scream a coherent plan.
I think one of the things that is overarching a little, and it was spoken about by Rachel Dory in the Hockey News actually, is this is all coming back to the MLSE board and the ownership of the Maple Leafs, the Argos, Toronto FC. You can go on, the Toronto Raptors. And all of them are in a bit of a mess and struggling to hold on to high-ranking executives. Like, you look at Tim Bezbachenko, he leaves. Yep. You look at the Kyle Dubas situation that's gone down with the Maple Leafs. Mm-hmm. That clearly was something that wasn't organized very well. You look at the Raptors seemingly struggling every offseason to hold on to Masai Ujiri, and Bill Manning running the Toronto Argos and TFC with basically no scouting background, but still thinking that he's one of the top scouts. So it all goes back to the MLSE board and the ownership from Bell and Rogers. Is it's not necessarily organized within that organization, and that can sort of reverberate around every property that they own. All coming to light now, because you're seeing the dysfunction with TFC, you're seeing the dysfunction with the Maple Leafs, and those are two of the big three that they have within MLSE. Of course, the Argos are also there. They're generally fine. But yeah, it's an MLSE problem from the top. And I think that was a great point put forward by Rachel. If you haven't read that piece on the Hockey News yet, I imagine most of our listeners don't read the Hockey News. But if you go take a look there, it adds a decent perspective. I also think that there's a big essence of scouting from TV. Like, you saw Insigne play well at Euro, score a couple goals. And
you know what's funny, though? He didn't even play that well at the Euros. Scored one nice goal against Belgium and had a couple of flashes. But then once Leonardo Spinazzola got hurt, his form went off a cliff. So he didn't even really play that well throughout the entire tournament, in all honesty. And that's the funny thing about it. When you see the Bill Manning quotes about how, yeah, I saw him playing for Italy, went to transfer market to see which national team players were on free transfers coming up. And we had obviously a massive celebration in Little Italy and all this. And I saw Insigne, I thought, oh, that's great. I'm like, there are probably seven other players on that team that I would have chosen before Insigne, which is the funniest thing about the whole thing.
Yeah, and I mean, you probably could have gotten some of those players with the kind of money that they've thrown at Insigne and Bernadeschi, and debatably one player could have done more than the two of them, because they've both been under-delivering. Of course, Bernadeschi a little bit better, but it all just shouts you're not doing your due diligence on signings. I mean, credit where they're getting a few players out of their academy now who are delivering by force of the situation. But yeah, like, you've got to have a bit more due diligence in your scouting, and it can't be just your president sees a player he likes on TV and some celebrations in Vaughan and Woodbridge and say, yeah, I want that on my team.
How about this for a suggestion? How good would Giorgio Chiellini look in TFC and maybe on a TAM or a low DP duel?
I mean, yeah, that's one of the seven or eight players I would have chosen before Lorenzo Insigne. Bernadeschi, by the way, solid signing as well. Like, if you would have given him that deal, which probably still would have been a bit of an overpay, totally fine. Because you know that he would have been able to have lived up to it, right? And he proved that the moment he got here. Yeah, this year hasn't been as consistent, but you can probably say that's just due to the dysfunction that's happening around him and maybe not being able to vape as much as he'd like. But otherwise, that to me just goes to show you, like, there were so many other candidates on that national team that you could have brought in certainly other young players you could have brought in too from South America with that $15+ million. And there was a lot more spent, by the way, when you include imaging rights and everything else on Insigne, that you could have easily spent on bringing in a couple of really good signings from outside that realm.
To argue as well, though, to be fair on the Insigne, you also could wonder, what does this team look like if you make the Insigne signing? You want that splash. You want that guy who brings that sort of profile and obviously the goals in Napoli, et cetera. And then you invest on a young midfielder, say, and you don't bring Bernadeschi. Because I also do feel it's one of those where the top heaviness of the roster build continues to maybe show, in the sense that there's a certain way you have to play when you have two very high paid wingers who love to, you know, seemingly just take players on 1v1 and want to cut inside. There's a certain, I just wonder again, if TFC had a bit more balance in the midfield, you only had Insigne, like you made, because they obviously made that signing first. It was a big priority. It was a big splash. And then, you know, maybe you make the team a bit more of a, you know, balance and centerpiece around Insigne. I'd also argue that, because I mean, there is something where if you statistically, yes, Insigne maybe wasn't necessarily that guy in you know, on Napoli as much as some of the other players were, but I think his numbers were elite enough. And there has been a history of, okay, you don't have to be a guy at some of these top European teams to come be the guy in MLS. But the fact that they brought in a guy like Insigne and a guy like Bernadeschi, who obviously both want to be the guy, could also, you know, you could argue, what if you just had one and you maybe had a bit more of a balanced squad, a bit more robust midfield, just to kind of play, you know, counter logic to you know, the Insigne and Bernadeschi thing, if that makes sense.
But moving on in our MLS roundup, Bradley, of course, left Bernadeschi out of training and the matchday squad against DC United. TFC then beat DC United 2-1 to snap a 5-match winless streak in all competitions, and Insigne getting 2 assists in that one. A question from Shane Kelly at Shane_Kelly. Did that win against DC United save Bradley's job? And it was a terrible DC team, but do you think that young midfield provided a blueprint for how this team can cope without Michael Bradley?
I don't know if winning or losing would have saved the job either way, because it seems Manning's pretty committed to him regardless. So I'm sure it didn't hurt, that's for sure. Getting a win and snapping a 5-match winless run also helps in that regard, but I don't know if it would have done much. The midfield itself, I liked certain parts of how especially Thompson and Marshall Ruddy performed in that game. Kay as a pivot, as a holding midfielder, I thought had one of his better games of the year, to be honest. I thought he was really poised back there, precise with his passes, pretty assured. Maybe that's his future role from here on out, who knows. The one thing I'll say about Marshall Ruddy, and I thought he had flashes still, yes, but I thought he played it safe more often than not on the ball. Made some pretty good runs into the box and everything else, but that plus the fact he still needs to adapt defensively are probably the two areas where he needs to grow in that Jaden Nelson-like role, which is exactly how Nelson ended up getting the move to Norway. So perhaps that's something that he can grow into. I think he can. He's still very, very young. People do forget that. He's 19 years old, almost 20 years old now. Thompson, I thought, was brilliant, especially off the ball, just covering the amount of ground he did in that right half space. Obviously, the goal is going to be looked at the most, but I thought that was the most impressive area of his game on Saturday, was just how much he was tracking runners and making sure that Larea had support, and that enabled Larea to get forward a lot more often, DeAndre Kerr to get forward a lot more often, who had a really good game as well. So you'd probably prefer Osorio replacing one of those guys, maybe Marshall Ruddy once he comes back and he's fully fit and everything. But if you went Kay Osorio, Thompson, or some combination of those four guys, I think that's a solid enough midfield to kind of get you through at least a regular season and maybe start to push towards the playoffs. Who knows?
And from Jordan SC, are we going to overlook the fact how TFC were playing well and Insigne was gone and it was Federico Bernadeschi who was carrying the team?
Hey, Jordan's just making my point. Insigne, to me, he has to play in a very specific style. And I broke this down on TFC Republic when he first got announced as TFC's marquee signing. The reason he had such really good seasons under Sarri was He had Fawzi Goulam as the left back, very attack-minded left back who was not afraid to go up and down and cover the space. Marek Hamsik, who was obviously an all-action midfielder, and those triangles were so lethal. Insigne was making third-man runs off of Mertens and Callejon, and sometimes Hamsik, depending on his role. And you don't really see that with TFC, whereas Bernadeschi, I feel, is a little bit more fluid in how he can fit into things. He still has to have a bit more width from his right back, and Larea will obviously provide that in order to, I think, seamlessly adapt in a system. But generally speaking, I don't think it's a surprise that when Bernadeschi was in the team, they were still grinding up points, getting wins. He was decently effective. And then with both of them coming back, they ended up obviously going on that tailspin.
And from Tommy Combe, what do you think the problem with TFC 2 is? Does the lack of success stem from organizational dysfunction, or is it the actual quality of the players? It's shocking how many good players from the GTA end up elsewhere. Now, I do have to say, they have been getting their opportunities with the first team now because of all the injuries and because of the dysfunction, and some of them have been delivering.
Yeah, I mean, Kobe Franklin certainly has stood out in this past stretch at left back. You know, obviously a more of a natural right-sided player. I have to be very impressed with just his poise on the ball and 1v1 defending. But ultimately for TFC, and it feels like that's what's kind of been the problem, is just a lack of a plan for a lot of these players. Like, I think there's just countless examples. I think if you want to look at this roster, how about Jaquil Marshall-Rudy? Like, this is a player who came in at 15, and there's all this potential, all this hype, and now we're sitting here, you know, about to turn 19 this summer, and you're just kind of like, obviously there's still potential. Like, 19 is still super young, but you're like, what has been the plan with him? Just play sporadic minutes each year if there's an injury crisis? Or, you know, last year he finally seemed to get that start, then he gets injured and just kind of never got back in. And something where, you know, there's just not enough, say, like, linear thinking, so to speak, with the development plan. Like, there's not looking at certain guys like, okay, he needs to go on loan for a year to kind of hit that reset button, or to do this and to do that. And at least if you look at some, you know, you look at the other two teams, maybe like Montreal and Vancouver as parallels, at least with Vancouver, there's at least more of a clear plan now that they have a second team back. Obviously they didn't have one for a while like TFC has, and you can already see the fruits is paying in that regard. And they have also sent guys on loans in past years just to get that extra year of development. Obviously Montreal's done a great job with the loans, whereas for TFC it just feels like there's all these players and there's no plan other than if a guy gets injured, you step up, and if you take your role, then you stay in. And if not, you're going to fade in the weeds for a while, which is like, it's something where you need a succession plan. You need something where you're like, okay, at the very least, we'll pencil you in if X player leaves. If not, we'll send you out on a loan. And yeah, it's just funny that the only guy we've really seen sent out on loan is a guy like Luke Singh, who just feels like he's not a part of those plans. Or it's like, could a guy like Marshall Rudy not be benefiting, some of these other youngsters not be benefiting from getting regular minutes? And I think that's kind of, again, it goes back to our earlier point about lack of planning.
CF Montreal edged Inter Miami 1-0 in Kamal Miller's return to Stade Saputo. Are they back on track ahead of the Canadian Championship final?
I would say that this was one of the few games they played this year where I thought they were good on both sides of the ball. The XG battle was quite close in the end, but Miami had a solid, you know, final 15-20 minutes of the game when they were pushing for a goal, so that's really why. Up until then, they were pretty much in thorough control. On the flip side, you would say, well, the two games off memory that they've had these dominant performances were against some of the weaker teams in the league. In Miami, in Sporting Kansas City, I know they've rebounded recently, but at the time they were woeful. But this is also, I think, what you're going to get from a team like Montreal, who's just so vertical and fast-paced and all action, and they're going to be solid defensively, provided they don't concede the first goal. And then if they can get that opportunity, then they're pretty okay with it being 1-0, and they just kind of pick their moments and get that second. I feel, though, that there are a lot of positives to see from this game compared to that Kansas City game, though, in that Sirois made the necessary stops that he had to make. He's having a solid, solid season. And the two clear-cut opportunities Miami had made top-drawer saves in order to keep his team in it. Chinoso Afor keeps impressing. Yes, he has some weaknesses. His first touch can be off sometimes. His finishing can be off. But he keeps popping up in promising positions every single game. With time, that's going to translate to more goals, especially at this rate that he's getting in into those promising positions. So there are lots of things to like, I think, about the Montreal side that we see now. And hopefully that now that they have a final to play for, they're treading water in MLS. They're kind of in and around that playoff bubble, which is, I think, where we expected them to be. Now we'll start to see, all right, who's the real Montreal now? Is it that early season Montreal who was kind of a disaster? Or is it more what we see now where they're not one of the best teams, but they're kind of in that mushy middle? And I feel like that's more so what they are. But they are in year one of a pretty solid rebuild here.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the cheap answer here is that this is just a Montreal side that is relatively young, that has just come off a lot of turnover, that is still only, what, 4 months, 5 months into, you know, the Hernan Losada era. And I think what we see is when they're at their best, you see some of the potential of these young players. You see some of the core pieces that they have, you know, when they can get that Victor Wanyama and Mathieu Chouinard midfield pivot solid. Obviously, we haven't seen Samuel Piette in a while, and that's going to be, you know, obviously a huge solidifier, so to speak, to their teams. A stabilizer, actually, is probably the better word I'm looking for there. You see a backline that stayed together for the most part, obviously barring Kamal Miller from Wilfred Nancy to now. But then also on the other side, you see some of that inexperience maybe in the attack as well. Been some growing pains as of late for someone like Sean Rea, who had those glimpses of, you know, a couple weeks ago, and now he obviously had a very frustrating game against Miami, comes on late in the game, comes off, and obviously was not happy with that. And we've seen some of that in attack as well. Chinonso Afor getting into great areas, can't finish. That's someone where he's obviously growing into that role. It's not Romel Quiotto, and you know what he's going to get, what you're going to get from him. And ultimately, that's what we're kind of starting to see with this Montreal team. I think they're a lot better than that start showed. Like, and then they've shown it as of late. But also, this is a young team, which I think as the year goes along, we're going to see a lot more of what they can be. And I think that's probably why we've seen it in glimpses and why it's kind of been up and down, especially as of late, because that's just the realities of a young team.
And the Vancouver Whitecaps lost 3-1 to St. Louis City. They've gone winless on the road in MLS play for a full calendar year. Vanni Sartini had some pointed comments for the officiating after that match.
That it's hard to win when the other team has 12 men. So that's the initial thought. And if we don't receive a letter from the league that apologizes for the shameful performance of the referee, it's something that the league can do it and should do it, because it's for the good of the league, because we export this product away. And when there's something that is completely shameful, unfortunately shameful, because it looked like the referee was a player for them, it's really hard to comment the game with, I would say, trying to get into the thing that happened on the field.
You have some strong opinions there. Why do you feel that it was shameful? Why do you feel that he was kind of playing for
every we didn't have any foul. Every foul for them was there. Every half and half, it was always two different measurement, never the same. And Jake should have been sent off. The free kick, it's our fault. Thomas made a mistake, but it's not a free kick. At the end, it's a free kick for us. They whistle a free kick for them, and they scored the third goal. And the management of the game was on one way. Probably he had a bad day, and I'm sorry for him. But if the league doesn't recognize that, there's a problem.
And from Oz Sweeney at Oz Sweeney 4, do you think that a CPL side goes after Thomas Asal? Seems a shadow of himself since his head injury.
I think he needs to play, because you see the effect that not having consistent minutes does to a goalkeeper like Hassall. And all the things that you saw are symptoms of that, in that he can't time his dives properly and then hold on to what seemed to be a routine save going across to his left. You know, just simple things like calling for a ball earlier than he should have with Tristan Blackman, which led to the own goal. Clearly their signals got crossed there. And it's also just a case of when the team is aware that the goalkeeper's not on his game or he's nervous, they're going to do that extra step that they probably don't need to do, like Blackman going for a diving header, just because, hey, I don't know if anyone's around me. Our goalkeeper's kind of struggling here. I need to play it safe. And that ends up happening. So I feel like for all those reasons, going to Pacific, where they still have maybe some uncertainties with their goalkeeping, Kieran Baskett's done pretty well, to be fair to him. But even just having that competition for all three goalkeepers could be really healthy. And you're playing in front of what is an established side, a solid defensive core. And sure, you might not get the volume you want, but you can still work on other areas of your game, like claiming crosses, communicating with your team, you know, having command of your area, things like that. So it's certainly a good shout to have.
And if not, I feel like, you know, Ottawa, depending on Nate Ingham's long-term injury status, obviously it looks like he should be back soon enough, so maybe not there, but, you know, if not York as well, based on, you could go push Nico Giantsopoulos, Halifax well. Certainly there'd be options as well, even beyond Pacific, although Isaac Bomer, having been loaned to Pacific in the past, there's obviously a bit of a relationship there for the Whitecaps. But ultimately, I think just Hassall needs a bit of a reset in terms of just new spot on, say, on a loan, reset, just find your feet again and go from there. Just because it feels like the last few years have just been so stop-start for him. I think 2020, he was in that form. He was obviously great out of MLS's back, gets the head injury that Oz obviously mentions. But, you know, then in 2021, that was Max Crepeau just going supernova back from that injury that allowed Hassall to get that opportunity in the first place. Okay, that's normal. Crepeau gets traded. I think this is kind of where it all starts, is Crepeau gets traded. First of all, Axel Schuster makes a very public claim, Thomas Hassall is your number one. And to be fair, they wrote that out. And he was actually showing some great signs of growth, that clean sheet against Toronto FC, you know, right before the game he gets injured. He was great, and you see the growth, and then he gets injured, and it kind of restarts the progress. Crody Cropper comes in last year, holds the net maybe a little longer than he should have based on the underlying numbers. Then you're kind of back at square one with Hassall, you know, by the fall. Again, he comes in and he ends up doing well, but then you upgrade your goalkeeping position. I think it's one where, based on all this, maybe the time to send him on loan in hindsight, of course, hindsight always going to be 50-50, is when Takaoka comes in, especially seeing how much of the guy he is. Because, yeah, I think it's something where if you're going to keep a backup around, you play him, especially a guy of Hassall's quality. Again, I find it, if you're not going to be trusting the guy to be playing against York, to be playing against Pacific in the Cup, then he should have been on loan to a CPL team earlier this season already, right? Like, if you're going to have a backup, then what's the point in that regard? But I think it's something, because of all that, I think it's time for a loan or some sort of reset, just so he can find his confidence again. I think it's something as a goalkeeper. Yes, it's rough to see what happened to him in St. Louis, but on the other side, like, he hasn't played in a while. He's only played LAFC away, where he got thrown to the Wolves, Real Espanyol away, which wasn't easy because it was a completely rotated team. And then again, you go to St. Louis away, your first game in weeks. That's something where, yeah, I see a reset.
And in our CPL roundup as well, in the CPL, Forge stayed atop the table with a narrow 1-0 win over Ottawa. Pacific remained second after drawing 1-1 with the HFX Wanderers. York United beat Calgary 1-0, and Vancouver FC drew Valor 0-0 in Langley. Are Forge pulling away from the rest of the CPL?
I think we expected them to be the favorites to win the league again this year and probably top the table during the regular season, win the North Star Shield. They were very lucky to come away with anything, let alone a win against Ottawa. Ottawa thoroughly outchanced them, but Tristan Henry just came up with save after save after save to keep the 0-0 intact. And then David Schwanier comes off the bench and just scores a lovely goal, you know, using his patented footwork there. So I'm not too surprised by how it's turning out. There have been a couple games where they maybe haven't been at their best, but that's the Forge mentality now. They're super deep. They got many options to throw at you. Guys like Mandrakar James have come in and just been absolutely immense. Even guys like Abubakar Sissoko, who've been there for a year or two, have just shown so much growth and have become pillars of that team. Same with Alessandro Hojabrapur. So put all that together, and you have a Forge team that is very clearly the favorite to repeat as champions again.
And also, I'd say I'd throw into that mix again, Forge, no surprise. I mean, there's a reason why most people had Forge number one in the preseason predictions. But also, I think Pacific is the one that's not surprised me, because again, I think the quality's there. But the fact that, again, they're just within 3 points as of right now of Forge, if I'm not mistaken, could be four, despite some of the goals they've given away and points they've dropped because of, obviously, you know, Emil Gazdov young adjusting to the CPL. I think that's also, that's been surprising about Pacific. Cause I think in my preseason preview, I said, obviously very deep team Pacific, don't sleep on that. Obviously goalkeeping an issue, not an issue, but like a question mark. Cause it's just two young goalkeepers pushing. But I also think the fact that Pacific is as close as it is could be interesting. I think ultimately Forge's depth will probably allow them to pull away. But so far, given the fact that both Forge and Pacific were the two teams that went the deepest in the CanChamp, yet are the two teams at the top of the table, the fact that they're both going to only have the league to focus on could make for a decent two-horse race if Pacific can pick up some points, especially if they, the next time they play Forge, if they can maybe grab a win and tighten up the table in that regard.
And has York turned things around?
Yeah, it's been huge to see. And obviously, the nice thing is about everyone drawing each other is that you string a couple wins together. All of a sudden, you go from near the bottom all the way up to third, as York has done with their back-to-back wins. And I think with York, it feels like we're seeing a culmination of two factors. I think factor number one is that, look, ever since Mobabuli came back last summer, or late last summer, early fall, they've been an elite offensive team just in terms of their XG numbers, their chance creation. And even when he's not been in the lineup now, they've built up enough depth with some of their signings that you look across the ranks, they've got guys who can score. It's the numbers are there. It's just really if Azase de Rosario and Brian Wright weren't so snake bitten in front of goal, they would have had way more goals than they do now. And then on the flip side, we've seen the offense find a bit of life, but we've also seen the defense stabilize a bit. Obviously, losing Dominic Zator was tough in the offseason. But I think one thing's kind of been clear since his arrival, at least, is that Tasmor Dakoutis has been a very good pickup for York. When he's been playing, they've been a borderline playoff team with their points per game average versus without him. They've struggled. I think the fact that Murdakoutis has been able to play there, and even though they're missing center backs, like Paris G's playing center back, and you know it's obviously not his natural position, although he does help a lot in the build-up, just having that sort of rock back there in Murdakoutis has helped them a lot defensively. And they've had two very good games where they haven't given up a lot of chances. And hey, that's a recipe where with York's talent, if they can keep defending the way they can, they will push up the table.
It's funny Alex mentioned Osasi de Rosario and Brian Wright snatching at chances, but I feel like De Rosario's still been pretty quiet to start the year. He also did start out very, very hot last year in his first season. So I feel like maybe he could end up having a contrasting season this year. But when you look at what York has, and I'm probably going to have to take an L here for a lot of this because I figured they wouldn't make the top five, but their midfield options are really coming together. Matthew Baldissimo, Brem Sumaro, you got Jeremy Gagnon-Lapere now coming back. Usama Alou has been a revelation in that number 10 role. So you got a lot of options. Plus Mobabuli's coming back, and we know he can play multiple roles too. Paris G has been a fantastic addition for them defensively, and the numbers are improving defensively as more guys get healthy as well, so that's a positive. But on the striker front, I feel like Brian Wright has been very quietly effective. I'd start him more because if Dero isn't firing on all cylinders right now, you're hurting your chances of winning more games. And plus, it could maybe also light a fire under Dero as well to finally come good in what's been a relatively disappointing start as well.
And Calvary is still struggling in the league. Should there be concern building around Tommy Wealdon's boys?
Yeah, they look so good against Ottawa at home, and you felt like they'd kind of turned the corner. They were playing a back three, some bit of OG Cavalry, 2019 Cavalry. They go back to the back four against York, and look, I'd want to see them continue the back three, because again, that's the first time it feels like all year they've looked like old Cavalry. It feels like this year they've just hasn't been that same Cavalry. They've been giving up a lot of cheap leads. They haven't been able to just get that sort of mentality, that spirit that they have. They haven't been bad per se, and that's why it's been so weird to watch Cavalry. Like even against York, obviously they go down and they still had good moments. They also got very unlucky with an offside call that was quite clearly onside and could have very well led to a goal. But I think Cavalry of 2019, if it's something like that happens to them, they're like, okay, whatever, they pick it up and then go and score a goal. And I think it's something where obviously that goes beyond tactics, but for what it's worth, they've looked their best with the three. I feel like if they can get those three center backs, they would stop maybe giving away some of the cheaper goals they've given, and it also helped them a lot in their build-up play. Obviously, it's a tough call to make, because I think if you're playing three at the back, you're sacrificing either a Kentave or a Camargo, because I don't think Moosey gets dropped given how good he's been. But sometimes it's one of those where maybe bringing a Kentave or a Camargo off the bench and just having what playing in a back three can bring you will help Cavalry a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. When I see Cavalry, I don't see the same fluid attacking orchestration still as years past. It's a lot of individual brilliance from Moosey and Camargo. And oftentimes there are free runners in the box and whoever has the ball opts to do it all himself. That never happened before. And this happened ad nauseum over the weekend from basically what I saw there in that York game. They missed two brilliant headers against York, and there have been some opportunities where they've just not been able to put them away, and that's going to happen. And even in that York game, they were probably the better side overall. They just couldn't finish. They're about mid-table in every major underlying metric, but it means nothing if they can't get the attack clicking again. Plus, the midfield is much thinner than it's ever been, and that certainly isn't helping things either.
And from David Anthony at @A_Miller16, what do the Wanderers need to do to finally get their first win under Patrice Guizer? I think their record is unfair to their actual quality. Of course, a lot of draws in there. They're not losing games, but they're not quite able to get that over the ledger and actually win.
Yeah, it's the million-dollar question. How long is it going to take for Patrice Guizer to get that first professional win? Poor guy is being made to sweat for it. But it does feel like ultimately the underlying numbers and the eye test show that they're playing good and pleasing soccer. They're getting the ball to the right areas. She feels like, A, they need to start finishing more of their chances. Other than York, who is underperforming their XG by 3, the Wanderers are actually just as bad at York in terms of underperformance. It's just, obviously, York's was so drastic because it was Di Rosario. It's right. It's guys who've scored in this league before not scoring. And you're like, oh, when's that going to change? With the Wanderers, it is a bit of a question just because there's inexperience there, so to speak, as in a Kwosi Nwafaso, a Thiago Coimbra, Teo Kalam. These are all guys who are, you know, playing in college either a year or college or League One within a year or two seasons ago in the case of Cologne, or obviously Coimbra coming from the Palmeiras youth system. So this is him kind of taking his first steps in the pro game. So obviously they're going to need some finishing from those guys. Again, Lufumpe Mwande, how has he not gotten more minutes? That's something I pose. But you look at otherwise when Lorenzo Caligari's been in the lineup, and for the most part, they've been good enough defensively that, you know, other than that game against York where they were missing Caligari and allowed 3 goals, they've been in it defensively. I think for them, if they can get some of those younger strikers to find some rhythm, find some goals, you know, and really get that breakthrough, I think Halifax will start to get the wins from there, because on the ball and, you know, defensively when they're set, they can also transition. It is something where they do need to continue to clean up.
Yeah, I think it all just comes back to finishing luck for Halifax, at least in a few games. Part of it is adapting to a new coach and system. Lorenzo Caligari missed some time, which didn't help them against York. I reckon they maybe could have gotten something from that York game with him in the fold, because they were just so poor in transition and committed so many costly turnovers centrally. I did like some of the tweaks that Guizer made, and that Fernandez was much more effective as a right wing back against Pacific than he has been as a winger. Maybe that's a permanent tweak that can be made from here on out. And Guizer still doesn't seem to know who his best number 9 is. Maybe Theo Kalam is that guy, but that I feel is the burning question right now, because everything else seems to be okay. It's just actually once you get into the box, who's going to put those chances away? I even haven't hated Halifax defensively either. I think Nimick, Laurie, and Ruby have been solid for them for the most part. I don't think Fillion has been an upgrade in goal, at least to the eye. He seems to not make as many decisive saves as you'd want from a goalkeeper. That's not to say he's the problem, but if you're not getting that crucial save or two from a goalkeeper in a game, that can really hurt your momentum as well.
And from Oz Sweeney, noted Whitecaps fan on Twitter, I do have to say, has the Chihuahua of Langley, Sean Hundal, learned his lesson about running his mouth and bringing nothing to back it up? I would have loved to see the Whitecaps play Vancouver FC. I think that would have been a fantastic match.
Yeah, obviously, it's a shame we never get to see that this year. Maybe next year we can get some Vancouver FC and Whitecaps and see the energy a game, a derby like that would bring. But I mean, look, it's something for Hundal. I would say, on his, you know, if you're going from his perspective, I mean, he said obviously what he said against York after scoring his first goal. He then had goals in back-to-back weeks after that. Since then, they went to Forge away. I mean, obviously not the easiest game in the world to play. Obviously, there was also the Ottawa you know, debacle, so to speak, with all the injuries and everything. And then last game here, he was put on the wing. Very puzzling, so considering he looked so good at the number nine. So obviously he's gone a bit quiet as of late. Part of it is, you know, down to his control. Maybe can he get a goal against in that Ottawa game, but also him playing on the wing against Valor was a very puzzling decision, given that he's looked best up front. But ultimately, I think it's one where, he had his bit of fun. The Whitecaps had their bit of fun with it. We'll see if that sort of discontent ever carries over to when they play. But I think it's something where, look, the comments were funny when they happened. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like they've just kind of faded in the memory. And I'm sure Hundal will continue to score goals. I'm sure the Whitecaps, for them, they probably forgot about that about 5 minutes after Gressel had his comments about it.
And from Johnny Lohr at J on the Spot 12, what do you think the criticism CPL is getting against CEBL regarding their TSN deal? Both are gambling in their own ways. CEBL has to pay their own production, but gets to be on TSN, while CPL gets to focus on its product, but should be doing better. And I think CEBL, I've said it on this show before, has done absolutely everything right, from connecting with communities to going to smaller markets right off the hop to folding teams when they didn't work with the Newfoundland Growlers because it was in too small a venue, and getting on CBC within their first few years. Now getting on TSN, bringing in NBA-level talent with Chuck Swirsky making his return to Canada as a play-by-play guy. I just think the CEBL is doing everything right. The CPL, as much as I enjoy the product, it's not on TV and it's not on a major carrier. Even if you got One Soccer on TV, there's no guarantee people are going to be watching that, right? Like, there's hundreds of channels people with cable get, and there's no guarantee people are going to watch that. But if they're on the major networks, or they're on TSN Go or something like that, like, there's much more capability. So I think the CEBL, I have to side with them, because I think they're doing it the right way. And it's been clear in the sort of social traction that they've gotten with that league.
It's very fair to, you know, the CEBL deserves its plaudits for what it's done in terms of pushing its product and really leaning into the growth of basketball, especially, you know, I feel like they've done a good job of leaning into that urban, smaller community feel that the sport is known for and is, you know, maybe just lacking in Canada, but beyond the fact that there's just the Raptors and that's it. To be fair, though, on the flip side of the CPL, I guess the nuance, I guess, would have to be considered in the debate is especially a carrier like TSN and the kind of attempts that have been there, just to kind of nullify, I'd say, the product on TV, so to speak. I'm just saying there's obviously not a CEBL broadcasting versus TSN or Rogers or whatever Bell course in the CRTC versus, obviously, we've seen what's happened with Media Pro and One Soccer versus TSN. So I just do also think there's other external factors at play that have obviously hindered that. And, you know, so credit to the CEBL that, you know, those hindrances haven't been there. They've been able to get a deal like this. And I guess if anything, it just almost makes you just show like, oh man, what if for the CPL, if they can get some sort of, deal like this where they can get it on TV more regularly.
And also coming up this week in North Carolina is the soccer tournament. It's a 7-a-side tournament with $1 million on the line, similar to the basketball tournament, which debuted last year. And there's some former CPLers, some former Canadian national teamers as well. Lauren Sesselman is playing, Dwayne DiRosario is playing, Thomas Skublai is playing, Jody Chiar is there. But in honor of all of that, we decided that we were going to pick our CPL 7-a-side team. And we have some rules for it as well. It's 7-a-side, 1 goalkeeper and 6 outfield players. 1 player from each CPL team, so 7 starters plus a super sub. They must include 5 Canadians and 1 under 21 player.
This was very difficult to choose, but keep in mind I had to make some concessions just to fit in certain players. So my goalkeeper is Ryan Yesley of Valor. And from there, I basically went with a very fluid 2-1-2-1. And you're going to see what I mean by fluid here very shortly. So Caden Chung is one of my defenders. He, of course, of Vancouver FC. Jean-Daniel Assi is my other defender, but also not really. He's just going to be like a wide player who can kind of get up and down as he pleases. Manny Aparicio, Kyle Becker are my midfielders. Ali Moussi is one of the forwards. And then Osase de Rosario fills out the rest of my team. a super sub, just while we throw it in there, I have to go with Mo Babouli just because he's played indoor soccer before professionally. So I feel like that would just be the next best step is to choose him. But I had to fill up somebody with some height. I don't have a lot of height in my team. Osaze can fill that. He can hold up the ball if I need to go long and filter it up to my speedy kings.
It doesn't sound like one per team if you got Babouli and De Rosario.
Babouli is the super sub. Played a bit of a wild card. Just because.
Well, then, are you missing a team then?
I'm missing Halifax, yeah, like, but I couldn't pick. I just couldn't choose anybody because everybody had their position filled, and maybe Caligari could be my super sub otherwise. But I just went with Babouli just because I figured, I picked one per team. Let's double up in this case.
Good to know that Peter is of the Miami school of thought when it comes to roster builds. Rules aren't for everyone, am I right?
Yes.
And Alex, how about your roster?
I went for a bit of some different picks in some regards. Obviously, some crossover, I imagine, there will be for all of us because there's some players you just can't ignore. But there are a few logical reasons why I went with what I did. I ultimately settled on a 1-2-2-1 where the front two really plays narrow and the back two can kind of stretch out and help you play out the back. So in goal, I went with Rayan Yesli. I mean, I have to. It's a 7-a-side. You want the 6'7" keeper who's been playing very well and can cover the net and can play with the ball at his feet. I think that was just a free choice for me in that regard. Then to kind of anchor my team as that kind of one of the back and just kind of help play out the back and be a defensive rock, I figured you need a center back. I want Rocco Romeo of Vancouver. Very good with the ball at his feet. A bit of size as well, which is always useful. And then I went with kind of two sixes, but, they can also tuck back and join possession. I went with Lorenzo Caligari of Halifax, and I went with Sean Young as well, just because he can, drop in and shuttle the ball, kind of help that ball progression. Then I wasn't sure for rules for my 2-10s, because we said one U21 player must be in the squad, but I wasn't sure if we had to start him or not. So for my first team originally had Jean-Anil Assi as the left side of number 10 and Ali Moussi as the right side of number 10 underneath Mo Babouli. Come on, the street soccer legend, indoor soccer legend. You'd be perfect for a tournament like this. But say if I didn't need to start my U21 Canadian, someone noticed that I somehow left out a Forge player, but the player I have on the bench for now, if not, I would start and have Assi be my super sub. It was Kyle Becker. He's two-footed. He's very technical, and I just feel like he would destroy in a tournament like this. So that's my 7-a-side team.
Not bad for me. I've got Marco Carducci in net. I feel like just have a bit more of a player who can use his feet and get almost into that back line and help the midfield by allowing either one of my defenders, Caden Cheung or Matteo Debrienne, to get up into the midfield as well. That being said, my back line, Matteo Debrienne and Caden Cheung, just a two-man back line. Then I've got Mo Babouli on the left of midfield, Lorenzo Caligari in the middle, and Ollie Bassett on the right. And then up top, I've got Manny Aparicio. My super sub, Rubens Pesillas. So that's it for our 7-a-side teams. If you were listening and you want to provide your feedback on who wins this hypothetical 7-a-side tournament, please let us know who you think wins out of our three teams. And if you want to field your own team of 7-a-side, leave that in the comments at Northern Football on Twitter as well. Certainly an intriguing idea in the soccer tournament coming up June 1-4 in Cary, North Carolina. That one will be streaming on YouTube, so that should be fun to watch. But yes, leave your comments, leave your ideas about our 7-a-side hypothetical tournament and even field a team whether you want to or not. I don't know whether we're going to have $1 million on the line, though. And Canada's U20 Women's National Team is at the CONCACAF Women's U20 Championship. They're into the semifinals. They face Mexico on Friday after losing 5-2 to the U.S. in their group stage finale. Winner qualifies for the U20 World Cup. And from Kathleen Talks Footy at FootyCAF, what are your thoughts on how the U20s are performing? Do you see any of the Baby Reds on the plane to the World Cup? I could see Amanda Allen making the World Cup squad if she gets a few more minutes with Orlando Pride, but none of them have necessarily stood out to an extent where they've gotten those tastes with the senior team. You're not really making those gambles with the senior team when it comes to the World Cup, just giving experience to youngsters. So I don't necessarily see anyone cracking the World Cup roster, but I do see people cracking competitive rosters down the road. I think there's quite a few, But yeah, for this World Cup, I'm just not quite sure.
Yeah, if we're talking this World Cup, I think it's Amanda Allen, and that's pretty much it in terms of those who could crack. I think, again, Olivia Smith is probably the most first team ready of what we've seen. And that's also helped that she's already had a U20 cycle. She's continuing to get goals. We've also seen the flip side of Smith, where, again, there's just been that inconsistency at times, which is kind of why she made her debut at the senior level at 15. But then it's kind of been an up and down battle since. But I think someone, when she puts it together, and I think maybe playing at Penn State will obviously help a lot for that. And eventually, hopefully, she can go pro, soon enough. Maybe she'll be one of the players to watch in Project 8. In a couple years' time. And then ultimately, I think a lot of that extends to a lot of this roster, which, again, is relatively young. I think it's something where when you look at the potential, and we've seen it in glimpses, especially, in the early games against Jamaica, Panama, where they were controlling, they were dominant. Of course, they were expected to do that. You see it. But again, you look at the U.S. as well. You kind of saw the flip side of the inconsistencies, especially in that first half. Like, that was just something where, look, against the team of the U.S., you can't give away a cheap goal the way they did the first one, where, you're playing out the back and your goalkeeper loses it. It ends up in your net. And then from there, you're playing a battle against a team that's favored to win. That's never a battle you want to face. And then they did well in the second half to respond and at least, push and fight. And again, that kind of shows some of those inconsistencies. And that also, again, shows the benefits of playing in a pro environment, because in a pro environment, you're working on those sorts of inconsistencies that all young players have, where, on their day, they can, be unbeatable and feel on top of the world. But the biggest difference between the pro game, and you can already see how much that has helped in Amanda Allen, for example, is just, again, your repetition, your day-to-day exercise. And because of that, I think Allen's kind of been the one that's stood out.
Getting into our Canucks Abroad section as well, the Northern Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Canucks Abroad. Find the full Canadian player pool and daily schedules for Canadians in action at canucks-abroad.ca. The season is over for most Canadians abroad. So who are three players, men or women, that really stood out to you? For me, it's got to be Jonathan David, Victor Leturi, and Chloe Lacasse. I would say that Jonathan David, just the way that he was able to consistently score, albeit a lot from the penalty spot in Ligue 1, was certainly something that we haven't really seen from a Canadian player outside of really Alphonso Davies in European leagues on the men's side. And so I think just the consistency that Jonathan David played with at that top level was something that deserves a shout in answer to this question. For Victor Leturi, of course, he's been on a Ross County team that has not certainly been that competitive this season in the Scottish Premiership. They've got the relegation playoff coming up, so hopefully he does stay up and stay in that competitive league. If not, there could be a move coming for him. And my third on the women's side probably has to be Chloe Lacasse and the success she was able to find with Benfica this season. Of course, attracting more interest from abroad, getting some more chances from Bev Priestman and the national team. Would love to see her take that step up in terms of league quality, whether that's with Arsenal in the WSL or somewhere else in Europe. She's conquered Portugal, and I think there's only a way up for her. So certainly an intriguing season by her, a successful season, and could be a solution for Canada at the World Cup in terms of goal scoring.
Yeah, in terms of my three, and first of all, I guess a disclaimer off the top, no Swedish players for me, just because they're kind of starting their season. So no Derek Cornelius, no Evelyn Vienne, Clara Solarisi, et cetera. Obviously, a lot of encouraging performances, but they've just started their season. So I'm, obviously you want to look at more of those who are finishing. I think for me, it's a bit of an easy answer, but similar to Jonathan David, it's Kyle Larin. I think for him, it's a fun one just because of the contrast in form from the first half to second half is outstanding. To go from, barely making the matchday squad at Bruges before the World Cup to being someone who's 8 goals and 3 assists in La Liga on a, team fighting relegation, has scored against likes of Barcelona and Atletico Madrid and all that. And it really just serves as a good tale, I think, ahead of this transfer window. It just shows of go where, consider fit, consider all this sorts of stuff when it comes into a transfer move. Obviously, you can't predict you go to a Bruges and you end up getting, frozen out. That, that's obviously something that wasn't predicted, but it just shows the importance of maybe just taking that extra second to pick the right moves. When you look at some of these Canadian players that are going to be making moves, you think of Ike Ugbos and Scott Candies and some of those guys who are maybe moving on from relegation clubs. It's going to be very fascinating to see there. Otherwise, another player obviously only played half a season, but I just think the way Dominik Zator has adapted to Polish soccer and, you know, gone from the CPL and helped Korona Kielce avoid relegation, was playing 90s, playing CB, playing right back as well, and got into the national team fold. I think it's just awesome to see for someone of his age, and given, you know, that he'd put in his time in the CPL and is now pushing the national team roster pool. I really thought that was, you know, nice to see. And then over on the women's side, lots of good choices there. I'd probably go Julia Grosso, especially for her start to the season, maybe a bit pre-injury. Just she was so dominant on the ball, playing in that three player midfield, getting forward, getting all those assists. Obviously her and Juve slowed down a bit in the second half, but still I think overall was a very good first full season, we have to remember, for Julia Grosso professionally. Obviously attracted that interest from Man City for potential world record fee. So that just kind of gives you an idea of how things went, and excited to see what she can do in year two of full second season, pardon me, be it with Juventus or elsewhere, if a move materializes to bend the rules a la Peter and a la Ben, because I can't count to three. Also, I'm going to highlight a fourth player because I thought she really impressed me this season. That's Vanessa Gilles. Obviously, we've seen her rise over the last couple of years from her time at Bordeaux and going over to Angel City. And now just to make that jump up to Lyon and a club of that stature, and to just step in immediately and be such a big part of them, obviously winning the double this year, in France, and also pushing in the Champions League. It's exciting to see that her loan was extended as a reward for her play, and hopefully she can push for a Champions League next year. I think it would be great to see, and it would be that next step. But she just really grew in all areas of her game, already so good defensively, so good in the air. But, we just saw her play on the ball, her play in possession, and, you know, just how she's adapted to playing in a great team, which is always a good asset to have. I think it's, it's almost gone under the radar because we're kind of used to seeing maybe, you saw Kadisha Buchanan at Lyon for so long. Just, it's very impressive that that Gilles came in and filled Buchanan's shoes, really, because with the injuries at Lyon, Gilles ended up stepping up right away. So I feel like credit has to be given to her for that. As for some players who maybe you'd want to see more of, I think one off the bat has to be Leah Miller. I think it's something where after he scored, double digits with Basel the year prior in all competitions, was so lethal offensively this year. It's been obviously very up and down, and some of it out of his control, all the coaching changes, formation switches, etc. But it feels like something where you want to see him get to those heights, because he was just so fun to watch last year. And it feels like this season he hasn't really gotten that same confidence. And hopefully it's something where either if he sticks at Basel for a third year and maybe ends up playing a bit more of a natural position and can take that next step forward and get that consistency he had in year one, or if maybe it's a move elsewhere. It feels like he's someone where he's been on the cusp of the national team for a while for a reason. Like, the potential is there. When he puts it together, he's so fun to watch. But this just past club season was so up and down for him. Another one as well is Theo Corbiano. I mean, the potential is there. You see it in droves. There's a reason why he made his Wolves debut a couple years now, really. It was 2021, if I'm not mistaken, that he made that debut. But since then, it's just been, fight to with these loans. He had four loans. He had glimpses of, greatness and brightness across them, but also he's had moments of inconsistency, moments of struggle. Feels like a player, of course. It's a young winger, young talented winger. Sometimes this is the hardest reality of the pro game, whereas, look, it's not the youth level where you can take over a game at will at times. It's something where at the pro game, sometimes you have to really be willing to muck it up to earn those moments, to fight for those moments. And obviously that's been an adaptation at times. He's shown that those brilliance. Just think of that spell for Blackpool where he was on fire, but also we've seen the flip side of it. So someone certainly would want to see more on that side. As for the women's side, it feels harsh to say would want to see more, as in if they're doing bad, but I'm just curious to see how Khadisha Buchanan does next year, because I think it was something where coming over from Lyon to Chelsea, she, you know, really in particular around January, February, March, she really stepped up and went and played a huge role for Emma Hayes' Chelsea. And obviously with them winning the double, they ended up doing well. But I just feel like Buchanan has another level to hit, you know, based on her time at Lyon. And, you know, this is just her first season at Chelsea. So it'd feel harsh to put her in this category because she was very good this season. But I feel like she could really become, or be, not become, because we've seen it, but be one of the top center backs in Europe next, you know, next season, because obviously at times she was that this year. But between the adaptation after the move, it just feels like Buchanan could really pop off next year.
And for Montreal, or at Inter Montreal, in the eyes of John Herdman, is the Nations League more important as well as easier to win than the Gold Cup? Also, which three goalies would you call up for the Nations League and then the Gold Cup? And some news coming out earlier today from Josh Cloak announcing that Alphonso Davies will be with the group for the Nations League, but likely not for the Gold Cup. So I think by that, you're probably assuming that the Nations League means a little bit more to this Canadian group.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of been no secret. Again, it's the one where you're guaranteed to get your whole roster, right? It's one where it's that window right after the season. It's not as... going to potentially interrupt the preseasons, etc. So yeah, I think it's been clear the Nations League's been important for that, just because you'll get your full squad. Plus, it is a good point in terms of easier to win. Obviously, you're playing more, you know, good teams, full rosters, but it's just two wins. It's, you know, you're not having to go through the realities of a tournament and the unpredictability where you never know who you're going to face in the quarters and the semis based on results elsewhere. Whereas it's very clear, you play Panama in game one, you get the win. You play Mexico or the U.S., you look at the form, you know, Mexico is in, you'd fancy Canada in that game. If you look at the U.S. and all the inconsistencies and, you know, their coaching situation, you'd also fancy them there. So I think it's absolutely where the Nations League is more important. And if you win the Nations League, you tick off the trophy box and you can use the Gold Cup as a bit of a playground, which I think would be immensely valuable ahead of the fall, where you could potentially schedule some big friendlies ahead of next year, where you have the Copa America. So yeah, I think it's not surprising to see, you know, Herdman kind of admit that, because it's ever since we saw the schedules and we kind of planned it out, you're like, yeah, I think logically Nations League makes more sense. And I think, you know, it's not surprising to see those quotes.
And from WSoccerCA, at WSoccerCA, with a few players returning from injury with their clubs, Rose, Quinn, etc., how are you feeling about Canada's expectations for the World Cup this summer? Initially, I had the expectation of, like, win the World Cup or bust, because they were the Olympic champions, and I think that was the standard that they had set for themselves. But I still think it's make the quarterfinals at least, and see what you can do from there. Because I think this group just has to kind of match where they've been before. It's a much more competitive picture than the World Cup has been before. The amount of growth within the women's game in the last 4 years has been absolutely exceptional. And I think Canada has fallen behind in that. But going into this World Cup with the injuries, with the limited playing time, even players like Deanne Rose will have gotten, I still think the standard has to be a little bit lower than win the World Cup, which it was going to be initially for me.
Well, I think externally expectations will probably remain. This should be a team that makes the top four, and I think that's reasonable to have externally. This is still, again, the defending Olympic champions. You look on paper, this is something where that center back duo of Gilles and Buchanan with Sheridan in net is certainly among the best that can be put out in the world. Ashley Lawrence at fullback, Grosso Fleming in midfield. But I think also, if you're looking internally and, you know, maybe from a Canadian perspective, where you obviously we've seen what's going on, you know, just adapting and whatnot, I think it's something where, yeah, I think if you can make the quarterfinals, that would be, you know, a fair expectation, just because you look at the front line, there's so many question marks. Yeah, you know, obviously Jordan Huidema and Evelyne Vian are scoring now, but Evelyne Vian hasn't really been trusted to take the reins up front, and Jordan Huidema hasn't been able to translate some of that form consistently to just popping in goals for the national team. Obviously missing Janine Becky is a huge blow, and with Deanne Rose being a huge contributor but being injured, we don't know what kind of speed she's going to be at. So there's just so many questions up front. You talk about Adriana Leone as well, your one consistent scorer for Canada, hasn't been able to get minutes at club, even though she's gotten her loan with Portland, but it's been, you know, 20 30 40 60 minutes here and there. You know, it hasn't really been the 90s you'd like to be seeing her get week in, week out. Plus, even for the midfield, as good as it looks, we haven't seen Canada's best balance in midfield, right? Like, you know, Desiree Scott's been missing for a while. She's been a huge loss. We haven't seen that Fleming, Grosso, Quinn midfield that could offer you a bit of a more modern look that could go up against the other teams in the world. So I think it's one where ultimately, if Canada comes together, it's, you know, and plays to its full potential, I'd say a top four is reasonable. I think that's why external expectation will be that. But if you're looking at it realistically, based on what we know, what we've seen, just some of the injury concerns, et cetera, especially around the offense and maybe even in midfield, I'd agree with Ben in terms of that quarterfinal range, especially because you got a tough group. Like, again, it's 50 days away and we haven't been talking about it much. I'm sure they'll ramp up. Like, Ireland gave, you know, trouble to the US, and the way they play behind the ball is gonna frustrate Canada. We've seen Canada struggle at times against low blocks enough to know that. Nigeria, we saw what they were able to do against Canada with their push, and Australia as a host and as a deep team. They're also going to be no slouch. So it's something where the group stage itself is going to be a battle, but also maybe it's something where, to the flip side of all this, Canada has been a very good knockout team when they want to be under Bev Priestman. So if they can get out of the group and turn back the clock and go back to maybe a bit what's worked for them in the past, maybe that could also be a benefit.
And Nico Seeger also accepted a call-up to Croatia's U21s for the U21 Euros. And Vince Alvarado at Vince by Demand, do you guys have any theories on why we seem to have a poor record at getting Eastern European dual nationals to play for us? Just a coincidence or something more to look into?
Well, first of all, for the call-up, obviously, I mean, congrats to Nico Seeger. You know, it's a huge accomplishment to get called up, you know, to a team that has done as well as Croatia, you know, senior and youth levels. You know, it's just a sign of his hard work. And it's something we've said a lot where, look, we'd love to be seeing a youth national team where Seeger is passing the ball to Jesse Costa and, you know, Luca Colioso is running down the wing and, you know, Owen Goodman's in goal. And you could go down the list of, you know, Daniel Jebison's leading the line. But it's something I would say for all of them, like, good on them for taking these opportunities. It's something where if the opportunity is there, they're not having to choose, then take it. And it's something where they're not going to be cap tied for this. So certainly, again, congrats to him and power to them. And again, it just kind of leads to that never-ending discussion we have about youth camps and their importance. And but also on the flip side, this is also the reality a lot of other teams face. Like, I think a great example is Morocco with the World Cup. Like, you know, sometimes, you know, players are going to want to play for some of these bigger European teams at the youth level. And then maybe when they gets to the senior level, it's a bit harder to crack. You see some of them go elsewhere. That's just the reality we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years. You know, so many players have gone that route for various national teams. As for the Eastern European one, it is interesting because, I mean, myself, I do have some Eastern European, you know, descendants, so to speak. And there is a very strong pull for, you know, just home from a lot of Eastern European people. Is, you know, you talk to Croatians, Slovenians, Serbians, you know, a lot of the countries around the Balkans, there is a very strong pull for home. You see, there's very, you know, family is also a very huge part, you know, of the culture and, you know, and sticking together and friendship. I mean, you know, it's one cool thing with my last name. Anytime I see someone who comes from one of the ex-Yugoslav countries or something, there is a connection that's naturally there. And I think that does help of a bit of a pull that, you know, because of that, these kids grow up being close to their culture. They know what their culture is like. They've seen other, they've grown up and gone to the community center and, you know, hung out with friends, et cetera. And, you know, I think that helps. That's not saying that it's the reason why Canada's lost a lot of these players, but I just, when that pull is there, then you get that chance to call. It does make it a little easier in their circumstance. So again, that's just the reality of the community there. And, you know, again, we're a very multicultural country. It's something where that's kind of the beauty of it, is that we have all these players and people that come from these various countries, and
just turns out in this case that that pull and that pride for home has maybe certainly helped them stay closer to their culture, so that when they're making a decision, it's less awkward being like, oh, I'm representing a country I don't actually feel that close to. Like, I'm from there, but I don't feel that close to. No, they actually do have that closeness, that connection, which does maybe help at the final decision, say.
And that's all we've got from this episode, episode 123 of the Northern Football Podcast. For Peter, for Alex, I've been Ben Steiner. This is NFP. We'll be back next week for more of Northern Football. Remember to toss us a follow at Northern Football on all platforms, as well as at Galindo PW, at Alex Kongi Ruzic, and at Ben Steiner. Thanks so much for listening.